Today is August 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Philip Alexio in Washington. The FBI raids the Virginia home of Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's former campaign manager.
The interesting part that jumped out to me from the report in the Washington Post was that this raid took place one day after Manafort met with investigators from the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Answering questions about President Trump's alarming statement toward North Korea.
What is alarming, two ICBM tests in less than a month, two nuclear tests that took place last year.
Also ahead, the governor of Guam talking about North Korea's latest threat to launch missiles toward the island. And Andrew Balcheski with today's social media trend line. Well, North Korea state media on Wednesday quoting General Kim Rok-yam as saying Pyongyang was about to take military action targeting the U.S. Western Pacific territory of Guam, home to a sizable U.S. Air Force and Navy facilities. Kim, who commands the strategic force of the Korean People's Army, said the North would finalize a plan by mid-August to fire four mid-range missiles known as Hwasong-12 rockets toward the island. After passing over Japan, they would be expected to land in waters 30 to 40 kilometers off the shores of Guam. Now, the plan, unusual in its level of detail, would then go to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and wait for his order. This according to the state news agency. So what does Guam have to say about the latest provocations? We go to the governor of Guam, Eddie Calvo, who says the island is not panicking and is ready for anything.
I think for my administration, I think for the people of Guam, every threat is taken seriously. This is like the third or fourth since 2013. And so with that, there is worry, there is concern, but there is not panic. Things have changed since 2013 as we are looking at reports in the media. But then at the same time, also the government of Guam, our civil administration, together with our local Joint Region Marianas, the military command, and also in discussions with Washington, with the White House and NSA, we feel very confident in the ability to protect the island of Guam. So with that, it's important to give reassurance to the people of Guam that they must, conduct business every day as if it's an any other normal day. We get 10 to 15,000 tourists a day in from places such as Japan, places such as Korea, Taiwan, and China. We encourage the tourists to come on in as well. But at the same time, we're hopeful the decisions are moving forward, that cool heads will prevail, and we will not see any increase in terms of tension and ultimately hostility. So this island and its people have gone through a war. We believe it is a horror. But then at the same time, it's important, and I think that's been very important for our administration since 2013, to separate what the rhetoric that is occurring, and a lot of it through the media and through folks that are in positions of power, but get to the details of really what are the facts on the ground. What is the situation in regards to increasing of military movements in North Korea, as well as what is occurring on the ground in Guam? And I can tell you, after being briefed many times since 2013, as we have, as the civil government, worked more closely in coordination with the United States military, is that there is, I would say, a very strong, formal, organized system in place for any type of ramp-up in terms of some sort of action, and as well as the defensive umbrella that is a part of the United States and its allies' system in this part of the world. And I talk about defense assets in Korea and Japan, defense assets in the Western Pacific, and the defense assets that we have also in Guam. I feel very confident that our people are protected. And at the same time, we're hopeful that things will de-escalate. And we're also hoping that our leadership in Washington can work with our allies in Japan and South Korea and bring in those vested interests, such as China. It's to China's best interest that this thing calms down. Because, the direction that the North Korean leader is moving towards, there obviously is not the right direction. And aside from the United States, I think Japan and South Korea will also, if he continues this way, move in a direction that they believe is important for their safety and security as well.
And Governor, what are your thoughts about the way the president has responded to North Korea?
As an American governor in Ground Zero and a Chamorro Guamanian that lived his life here in Guam, if Guam or Honolulu or Los Angeles is threatened with an attack, it is my hope that a U.S. president will be very clear in his message to potential adversaries that it will be met with overwhelming force, and whether it's hell or fury or brimstone. So that is not my, you know, my concern. There was an issue brought up by a U.S. senator that that is looking towards initiating military option as an only option right now, and his rationale was that better there than here, which is U.S. homeland. And those are the warmongering that I'm concerned about, because aside from the destruction that will occur in this part of the world, that U.S. senator has to be reminded that there is a 600-mile long archipelago in the Marianas encompassing two U.S. territories, encompassing more than 200,000 people, and that if a war were to occur in this region, not only would tens of thousands American soldiers, troops, airmen and sailors and their dependents be at harm's way, but hundreds of thousands of American citizens in sovereign U.S. soil in the Western Pacific. So, I mean, those are kind of more of the issues I'm concerned about, is some sort of escalation in the part of folks that want to see the military action as the only option available. And I think as someone who had a parent and for parents and grandparents that have been through war and enemy occupation, that is the last resort.
The senator, Governor Calvo, mentioned is Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who said on CBS this morning, "I hope diplomacy will work. Sanctions have not worked before. Maybe they will now." Graham saying, but if there is going to be a war, it's going to be in the region, not in America. Now, as far as President Trump's fire and fury comments on Tuesday, Pyongyang state media saying the words are a lot of nonsense to Kim Jong-un, and that they only, quote, are absolute, or that only, quote, absolute force can work on him, Trump. On Wednesday, much was made about President Trump's strong verbal warning to North Korea over its threat toward the United States when he said this on Tuesday.
He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
So at the State Department on Wednesday, spokeswoman Heather Nauert was asked if the president was referring to a nuclear attack. She deflected to point out how dangerous North Korea has been.
As people look at this and some consider comments to have been alarming, I would have to go back to this. Let's consider what is alarming. What is alarming? Two ICBM tests in less than a month. Two nuclear tests that took place last year. As a matter of fact, when there's an earthquake in China, I get many emails and calls from all of you asking, was it another nuclear test? That is how big of a deal this is, that what is going on.
Let me just follow up.
Okay, please. Sure. It is a big deal what is going on. It is a concern to the world, not just the United States. Those are alarming actions. They are provocative actions on the part of North Korea.
Nauert also saying everyone in the administration is on the same page, especially in tone, but the words were the president's alone. And while flying back to the U.S. from the Southeast Asian tour that he took, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson addressing the language used by Trump, saying the president's words were meant to send a strong message to Kim Jong-un in a language the North Korean leader would understand.
I think Americans should sleep well at night. I have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days. I think the president, again, as commander-in-chief, I think he felt it necessary to issue a very strong statement directly to North Korea. But I think what the president was just reaffirming is the United States has the capability to fully defend itself from any attack and defend our allies, and we will do so.
Defense Secretary James Mattis said on Wednesday in a statement the U.S. and its allies would win any arms race or conflict with North Korea. He said the DPRK should cease any consideration of actions that would lead to the end of its regime and the destruction of its people. North Korea on Wednesday officially dismissing President Donald Trump's threats of fire and fury. This is VOA's International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, the United States expels two Cuban diplomats from the country. Claims of election fraud in Kenya are sparking protests. Claims that 50 migrants were deliberately drowned off the coast of Yemen, and more sanctions are placed on Venezuelan officials. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. You're listening to International Edition. U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation agents raiding the home of President Donald Trump's former campaign chief in the pre-dawn hours late last month, intensifying their probe of Russian interference in last year's presidential election. The raid on the home of Paul Manafort occurred just outside Washington, in his Virginia home, and without warning. Aides to the 68-year-old Manafort confirmed Wednesday that federal agents executed a search warrant on July 26, seizing documents and other materials. The raid coming just hours after Manafort had met voluntarily with the Senate Intelligence Committee, one of the several congressional panels investigating possible collusion between Trump campaign officials and Russian officials aimed at helping Trump win last November's election. Bobby Chacon is a retired special agent with the FBI, and International Edition's Sarah Williams asked him about the raid on Manafort's home.
The interesting part that jumped out to me from the report in the Washington Post was that this raid took place one day after Manafort met with investigators from the Senate Intelligence Committee. So now, and I'm speculating here, but there could have been something coming out of that meeting with those investigators if they spoke to the FBI, which they would have, that prompted the FBI to quickly do a search like that. You know, in this day and age where, you know, emails can be destroyed, and we learned that through the Hillary Clinton investigation. So, you know, the FBI is very aware that they want to, where in the past, if in this type of investigation, you would have given people the chance to produce documents voluntarily or via subpoena. Now it's different now because things can be destroyed. We've learned that. And so, you know, the timing of this one day after he met with Senate Intelligence Committee members or investigators could be telling. It might mean nothing, but to me, that's something that kind of piqued my interest when I read that part of the story. So the FBI would simply do this to preserve evidence that you know, obviously could be destroyed. And so, you know, we want to do these things to preserve. Now, he was under a subpoena, and he was producing documents pursuant to those subpoenas, you know, but if the FBI, through whatever reason, felt that he wasn't producing all the documents relevant, you know, under subpoena, you know, they may have gone in to seize things before they thought they might be destroyed.
Well, now, this investigation has been continuing, and has been examined as far as his involvement, possible involvement, links to the Russians. Does this seem that he's looked on now as a central figure in this investigation?
Well, you know, he's been investigated, I think, as far back as 2014 about his lobbying efforts on behalf of the Ukrainian government and officials there. Now, this new investigation into the Trump campaign, of course, he was the campaign manager, particularly at the time when the Donald Trump Jr. and Kushner meeting took place, you know, with that Russian lawyer. And I believe Manafort was actually present at that meeting. So, you know, sure, he is a central figure, you know, in this investigation, not only the investigation that went back to 2014, but even this new investigation from 2016 and the collusion investigation, you know, as the campaign manager and as someone who was present at that meeting that everybody seems to want to know about, sure, he would be a central figure in this investigation.
How close does this investigation seem to be getting to the White House?
Well, I mean, when you have, you know, the campaign manager of the presidential campaign, it's certainly, you know, very close to candidate Trump. Now, I don't know, you know, the question becomes, you know, one of behavior, right? Of either criminal behavior or not, when the behavior took place. And it could be, you know, was this you know, most of it took place during the campaign when they were working for, you know, candidate Trump. Obviously, Manafort was let go during the campaign, I believe, prior to the election. And so, you know, I don't know how much of this extends to the actual White House after inauguration. You could have, you know, attempts at covering things up that where the criminality may have occurred prior to the election, but the cover-up continued after the election. And again, this is all speculation. I don't know that there was any criminality. The investigators, you know, the grand jury and Mr. Mueller's team will determine that, and I have full confidence in them. But if it happened, then you've got, you know, possible cover-up activity in the White House.
That's Bobby Chacon, a retired special agent with the FBI, speaking from Los Angeles. Human smugglers drowned about 50 teenage Somali and Ethiopian migrants by shoving them into the water off the coast of Yemen, according to a migrants' rights group. Staff of the International Organization for Migration found the shallow graves of many of the young victims during a beach patrol in Yemen's southern Shabwa province. Survivors who buried the dead said that they were among about 120 aboard a boat sailing from the Horn of Africa to Yemen, a crossing of about 200 to 300 kilometers. That's a popular route for people, for smugglers, despite Yemen's civil war. The journey has been especially hazardous this year due to strong winds across the Indian Ocean. At least 19 militants have been killed in a day-long fight in western Somali in the region of Bakool. The clashes on Wednesday taking place between al-Shabaab militants and fighters loyal to former al-Shabaab leader Muktar Robo. Officials say in an al-Shabaab onslaught early in the morning forced Robo's loyalists to retreat from Abal village, but they later returned to beat back their attackers in a midday counteroffensive. Time now, it is 47 minutes past the hour. Time now for the social media segment, and joining us is Mr. Andrew Palcheski to tell us what's trending online today, and what have you got, AP?
PA, there's been a lot of talk about North Korea. Of course, a big topic in the news with the back and forth going on. Lots of people very concerned on social media about the potential ramifications, any future missile launches. You're seeing people even posting guides on what to do in case of a nuclear attack and where to take shelter. So people taking this very seriously. However, whenever you have even a serious situation like this on social media, there's always the dark humor. So a lot of people saying, well, that means I don't have to pay my credit card bill then if we're getting attacked, and all these other kind of things, trying to look on the bright side. It's also done a lot to raise the profile of Guam. Of course, that is the island territory that North Korea said that it would strike potentially with a missile launch, home to a lot of U.S. military service members and their family.
Of course, that threat coming after the president said he didn't want to hear any more threats.
Exactly. So the back and forth continuing there, and I think the threats will continue. One thing that I found very interesting is that there is an official North Korea Twitter account, and it tweets things out in Korean, kind of just headlines and press release type things. There's another account that's posing as an official North Korean Twitter account. That one is fake. The real one has about 18,000 followers. The fake one has over 220,000 followers. And the fake one is posting things that are provocations against President Trump, that are talking about, for instance, First Lady Ivanka Trump, making kind of crude references and jokes. The problem is some people are thinking that this is actually a North Korean-sponsored Twitter account, and so people are getting very angry at some of the things that are being tweeted out. However, that account is fake, so if you do see that account, you can know that that is the fake one. But just be careful, because some news organizations have been duped. There have been several instances where they've talked about this Twitter account as the real deal, when in fact it is not.
Oh, interesting. So they got duped on that as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So obviously this North Korea thing will be on the burner probably for a while. So what else do we have? We got something else on the schedule here?
Yes, in India, a great way that social media is being used to highlight sexism. This is a case where a young woman was being followed at night by the son of an Indian official. An official in the Indian government and political party member said that this woman shouldn't have been out so late if she didn't want to be stalked and put in an uncomfortable position. Women in India did not like that idea. So they have used hashtag Ain't No Cinderella to strike out against this. Of course, in the fairy tale, Cinderella had to be home before her carriage turned into a pumpkin at midnight. So these women are using this hashtag Ain't No Cinderella in India, and they are posting pictures of them out with friends, out at bars, out all kinds of places after midnight, and saying, you know what? I'm not a Cinderella. I don't need to be home by midnight. And just because I'm out late doesn't mean that I need to be facing this kind of fear or attack. So that social media hashtag has gone viral in India. Lots of women using that. And it's drawing a lot of attention to those comments and the sexism that they evoke.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you've got a big problem in certain parts of the world where you really have women being as if they're the ones who are causing all of these issues. They're just being themselves, and the men just using it as an excuse to go after them.
And that's the great thing about social media is that they can strike back. It's the democratization of information and the ability to speak out. And we've actually seen this before in Pakistan. There was a law they were trying to pass that would allow husbands to beat their wives lightly. And so the hashtag try beating me lightly was trending, and women were saying, here's what I'm going to do. If you try to beat me lightly, I'm going to fight back. And so that was another instance that we saw women in particular using social media. But we see this time and time again on social media where groups who are marginalized or are facing discrimination can fight back and can rally around these hashtags. So it really is one of the great uses of social media.
It really is fascinating how far, and it seems like it's like this every time we talk about this, at least for me, how far social media has come in the past 10 years, where it is today, and interestingly, where will it be really 5 or 10 years from now, and how much power and how much effect it has had on so many people.
Yeah, it's a fascinating trajectory. I think it's only going to grow and have more of an impact.
This tremendous ability to communicate.
Yeah, more and more people around the world are getting on social media, and so it really is the kind of marketplace of ideas or kind of this open town square where people can speak out, let their voices be heard. It really has become a vessel for that around the world.
All right, Andrew Palcheski, thank you very much. Excellent stuff.
Thank you very much.
And this is International Edition.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
A total solar eclipse will happen August 21st and will be visible across all of North America. Millions of people will watch, but looking at the sun without protection can cause eye damage and requires safety glasses, such as those made by the NASA-approved American Paper Optics Company, whose president is John Jarrett.
In an hour, we can manufacture more than 50,000 glasses an hour from start to finish.
NASA officials say homemade filters or sunglasses are not safe for eclipse viewing. But for those that will see the event, it will provide quite a thrill, says NASA scientist Michelle Thaler.
You can feel it coming. You can feel the temperature dropping. You can feel things changing and getting very strange.
NASA experts say another safe way to view a solar eclipse is through pinhole projection that shows a reflected image of the sun and doesn't require looking directly into the sun's rays. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
Well, many summer camps in the United States focus on a single activity like baseball or computers, horseback riding, those types of things. And there are also camps for specific groups, for Jewish or Christian camps and camps for children with autism or physical disabilities. Now there's a camp in California which is serving a growing population, transgender children aged 4 to 12 years old. Experts saying its rapid growth reflects the dramatic increase in children socially transitioning at younger ages across the United States. Faith Lapidus reports.
Rainbow Day Camp offers kids a welcome break from the academics of the school year and also from the stigma of being seen by society as different. These 4 to 12-year-olds are transgender. Here, they can use the pronoun of their choice and meet other transgender kids and adults, including many of the camp's counselors.
They're following their creative interests, and they don't have this added stress or weight of being othered. They get to be their most authentic selves and build community with other people who understand the same life experience.
Transgender fluid person.
The need for that community is what inspired Sandra Collins to start the camp 2 years ago.
I used to say that the camp began out of sadness because of this experience, but a friend encouraged me to reframe it, that the camp began out of love, out of trying to create a safe space for my daughter and then other kids who were like her.
There are more and more kids like her in the U.S., which does not surprise developmental psychologist Diane Ehrensaft.
We expect a two-year-old to know, I am boy, I am girl. So why can't that also apply to transgender children to know it just as well as children who aren't transgender?
Molly Maxwell says that's what happened when her child was a toddler.
Once she learned to talk and have a voice, it was just she was very insistent that she was not a boy, she was a girl, and to call her a girl.
A study released this year showed that allowing this social transition can have a positive benefit on young people's mental health. James Kaplan's mother doesn't regret allowing her child to transition.
I had to mourn the loss of my daughter and at the same time welcome my son and get to know him. And as soon as he transitioned, he was happier. He was confident. He was light.
The 60 kids at Rainbow Day Camp this summer are certainly happier.
I like to be who I am, and it's not fun to be who I am not.
I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can find us at voanews.com. You can like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and you can also follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I'm Philip Alexiou in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Security Council has passed additional sanctions aimed at increasing economic pressure on North Korea to end its nuclear weapons and missile development program. The resolution we passed, said U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley, is a strong united step toward holding North Korea accountable for its behavior. Ambassador Haley thanked all who voted in favor of the resolution, in particular China, noting their critical role on matters related to North Korea. This resolution, she said, is the single largest economic sanctions package ever leveled against the North Korean regime. It could cut North Korea's exports by a third, costing Pyongyang about $1 billion in revenue. Indeed, the North Korean regime forces their citizens to work in mines and factories in order to fund its illegal nuclear and ballistic missile programs, even as the regime continues to ask for international assistance to cope with devastating floods and a possible drought later this year. Its displays of aggression take precedence over the well-being of its own people. While the latest sanctions are a significant step forward, Ambassador Haley warned that the threat of an outlaw nuclearized North Korean dictatorship remains. Ambassador Haley urged all Security Council members to fully implement the new and previously imposed sanctions. Our goal, she said, remains a stable Korean peninsula at peace without nuclear weapons. We want only security and prosperity for all nations, including North Korea. Until then, this resolution and prior ones must be implemented to the fullest to maximize pressure on North Korea to change its ways.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.